This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hohoho Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Welcome, everyone, to the luxurious city of Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We are two simple Southern boys making our way through the Great White North to our studios in Hohoho Plaza. We're seated in an L shape right now. We can't even see each other across the room in our studios. They're so luxurious indeed and so large and L shape. I am Greg Phillips, and with me is the Doctor of Desire.
Oh.
Nicholas Duke.
Hi there.
And we are the hard-traveling fanboys. Nick, how fares thee on this anonymous day?
Pretty well, sir. Got a lot to talk about here. We've read some comic books. We've seen some films and watched television. So got a rip-roaring edition in store for everybody coming down the pike this week. So
that's right. A rip-roaring edition of
the long-running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. That was a pretty good one.
If we do say so ourselves.
And we do,
yes.
Not to toot our own horns, but toot.
Before we get cracking on this week's edition of The Long Book Hunters, which is what you're listening to right now, I would like to take a brief moment to advertise some guest shots that we've both made recently that have dropped on the feed. Now, Nick, you've appeared on the illustrious, the hottest new podcast in all of Place to Be Nation, Talkin' Pop with Jenny and Tim. And you recounted some of the stories of your WrestleMania weekend exploits, correct?
That is accurate, which you probably listened to, and one of the few things about that weekend that made you glad you weren't there was you listening to that podcast.
You know, I haven't listened quite yet because I've not had a lot of time to listen, but when I do listen, I'm fairly certain you may be onto something, my friend. You may be sniffing in the right direction, but we'll see. You never know.
You've
been known to surprise one another.
Not often, though.
On your occasion. And I am the guest on not one, but two podcasts, one of which is alongside you, Mr. Duke, because we took the time out of our day to join the Sellers Points podcast alongside Russell Sellers and newcomer Joe Johnson, longtime listener of the feed. And we discussed the historic Action Comics 1000, in addition to Doomsday Clock, and gave our predictions for Infinity War, which may not have been bold enough, quite frankly, even yours.
Mine was everyone, so.
I thought there was some caveat to yours.
No, there wasn't.
Well, find out by listening to the Sellers Points podcast, an enjoyable time reminiscing about current comics. It's not really reminiscing, but nissing about current comics, and that's a good time. And then, of course, I am the guest star on Survey Says this month, alongside Andy Helene and our good, close, personal, longtime friend Tim Capel, as we discuss the new world order. And it was a laugh riot and a fun time at the old office, including, Nick, an impersonation I think will be near and dear to your heart.
No. I will not stand for your mockery and blasphemy.
Ew.
God.
That's all I got for
you. That's all you got. That's all you got.
Yo. Anyway.
At least Hulk Hogan said things were miserable. Or miserable. Memorable.
They were miserable. You're right. He did. He said a lot of things that were miserable, especially anyway. In court. But imagine if there were a car that when you cranked it up made that noise. Yo! 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 It would be awesome. It would be a great engine to have in a car. I want one.
There's
I want a Hogan mobile, Nick.
There's a lot of jealousy going on in these impressions and these discussions. And that's fine. That's just something you have to live with, sir.
I'm just saying. I want a Hogan mobile, and I think you would have a Hogan mobile too if they made one. But they didn't. But what they did make is the iconic character of Superman. Now, we, of course, are in the 80th year of the Man of Steel, Superman. That's why we did the Sellers Points, to talk about Action 1000. We just had – think about that, folks. 1,000 issues of Action Comics. Superman began in 1938, Action Comics number one. And all these years later, we are celebrating Superman this year about the one of the biggest – the biggest icon in comics. And a little bit of synergy there. And Superman just transcends the medium. He's one of those characters like Batman, like Spider-Man, that transcends the medium of comics worldwide. Everyone knows who he is. Everyone knows his logo. And everyone has their own story with how they came to know the Man of Steel. Well, why do I keep saying the term Man of Steel? Well, that's also a bit of synergy, because this month's Long Book Hunters is our look at the classic 1986 miniseries, The Man of Steel. And this, of course, is a famous or infamous, depending on who you are in your Superman fandom, reboot of Superman by writer and artist John Byrne. This came on the heels of the Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is the landmark event in the history of DC Comics in terms of literally, and maybe to this day, one of the few events that ever in comics that ever actually lived up to the billing, nothing will ever be the same again. Right, Nick?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it set the template for what the universe-wide reboot would look like, at least in terms from a continuity perspective. You know, Marvel, DC both have had numerous publishing relaunches or reboots or what you call them over the years, but Crisis on Infinite Earths kind of set the template for how you pull off a reset of continuity across the board, and that's pretty much something that DC has fallen into the cycle of doing every... What would you say, Greg? 15 or so years since then, 10 to 15 years. They like to kind of give us a little reset and a refresh and forward. Mm-hmm. So, very influential, and it kind of set the stage for what was to come here.
Right, and maybe other than the new 52, I don't know that they've ever done one as hard of a reboot as this one, because Crisis basically took the DC universe as people knew it at the time and blew it up. Basically, and started from the ground level, eliminated the multiverse, which was a huge factor of what are known as pre-DC comics, mm-hmm. Took away a lot of the extravagancies that had cropped up, particularly from the 50s and the 60s on, and really aimed to streamline as best they could the DC universe into something that was a little bit easier to follow. And something that had a more arguably Marvelized approach, a more grounded approach to some of these heroes and villains, and kind of making them connect more on the Earth level, particularly with regards to what we'll get into with Superman. But it did away with a lot of the concepts like the super pets and things like that that you'd seen pop up over the years. And was aiming really very boldly to relaunch these characters. And so for each of their tentpole characters, they centered on particular creators. Famously, Frank Miller was given the reins of Batman to do both his seminal Dark Knight Returns and then especially to do Year One in 1987. So Miller was their guy for Batman. Shortly after Man of Steel, which came after the Dark Knight Returns but before Year One, they gave the reins of Wonder Woman to George Perez, which allowed Wonder Woman to be reimagined from the ground up. And for the Man of Steel miniseries, they turned to John Byrne, who may have been the hottest name in comics at that time. He was the writer and artist who had worked so famously this is funny. For some reason, as I was talking, Siri came on my work cell phone and asked me if I had meant Josh Duhamel. And I did not. I meant John Byrne. And he was, of course, he had worked closely with Chris Claremont on X-Men, mm-hmm. Uncanny X-Men, rather, as our buddies Todd and Tim have talked about. He also was responsible for Alpha Flight and countless other projects at that time for Marvel in particular. And this was his big journey into the DC universe and that he made alongside Marv Wolfman that blew DC away. And he was an A-list talent, so they probably would have let him do it anyway. And here we have it. John Byrne given the reins of Superman to reimagine him from the ground up, along with a little help from Marv Wolfman, little help from his inker, Dick Giordano, who was also a big editor at the time at DC. And they go about trying to recreate Superman for a new generation. Quite a task to undertake, wouldn't you say, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it, like you mentioned earlier, Byrne had kind of a name at this point. And it made sense, you know, to do this at this time. One of the large free agent creators that was out there for a project that DC had kind of been bandying about even before Crisis on Infinite Earths, from what I understand. It had been something that the Superman editors and Superman writers had kind of wanted to do. And so with Crisis, with John Byrne being available, all the pieces kind of fell into place. And while it was risky, it was something that – I would argue, you know, having read very little 70s and 80s or early 80s Superman, but what little I've read, I would argue it was probably needed at this point.
Yeah, I think so too, particularly from a personal standpoint. I don't know that I would have been as easily hooked into Superman when I was a kid if it had been the old continuity. Maybe it was because I grew up reading other Marvel comics or whatever. But for some reason, able to pick up a Superman comic and relate instantly to his isolationist nature, the fact that he's the last survivor of a dying planet, but he also identifies more with being a human. All these things that we'll talk about that were introduced here were a lot easier to connect to than the concept of there being an infinite number of worlds where things can happen and there are multiple different versions of Superman and, flying super ponies and super dogs and, you know, entire cities of Kryptonians and all that stuff. It was just easier for me to identify with something that was closer to the movie, I think, which is where a lot of people probably got their start on Superman, which the films definitely avoided a lot of the Kryptonian baggage, if you will, and focused primarily on him and Kryptonian villains you saw, but you didn't see a lot of other Kryptonians flying around or Krypto or any of that stuff. It was a very – in many ways, it was fantastical but a grounded movie. So, yeah, I think it was the right move. And one of the interesting things that I found out, Nick, and I think you were probably referring to this, is that they had been talking about rebooting Superman for a while. There were editors and writers who had been meeting for years to talk about this. The regular writer, Carrie Bates, apparently wanted to revise Superman but keep the continuity the way it was, whereas Marv Wolfman, Frank Miller, and Steve Gerber all had pitches to restart the continuity from scratch. They all had the same ideas: get rid of Superboy as a concept, cut down on Superman's powers, more vulnerable, change Lex Luthor, and make Superman the only survivor of Krypton, doing away with some of the other extraneous, in their opinion, Kryptonian characters, But every pitch they had was different. And let me just say, I am very thankful that Frank Miller didn't get to get the reins of Superman.
Well, you know, I mean, you know,
it could have turned out different.
That time frame, Frank was kind of at the peak of his powers. So
that's true.
It's not.
And I don't dislike Superman and Dark Knight Returns as much as most would, but I don't know. I just feel like Frank would have perhaps leaned into the.
Well, don't worry. We're getting Frank's take on the Superman origin coming up in Superman Year One, aren't we?
Very true. We'll find out exactly what Frank has to offer in 2018, as opposed to his prime. Vince McMahon ear tug.
Yes.
So let's just get into this. So this entire miniseries is written and drawn, penciled rather, by John Byrne. It's inked by Dick Giordano, and it is colored by Tom Ziuko. I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce that name. Edited by Andy Helfer. But this is, I mean, let's be honest, this is John Byrne's ship. He's captaining this ship. He's driving it. He is the storyteller across the board. And I think one of the things that I should mention is this is the version of Superman that I grew up with because of my age. I am 30, just turned 34. So I am a child of the John Byrne era of Superman. Now, my first comic book that I ever bought or ever had bought for me, I was 4 years old, and I believe it was Superman number 14 by John Byrne from 1988. And so his run was almost at an end because he left the book by the end of 88. But it was the version of Superman that he creates here in this Man of Steel miniseries that influenced the version of Superman that I love, which was the Superman of the Dan Jurgens and Roger Stern and Louise Simonson that we saw on things like Lois and Clark and years later on Smallville. A lot of the changes that were introduced by John Byrne were the ones that define the comics for 10, 15, 20, 30 years. Even to this day, I would argue, a lot of the changes now have almost been reintroduced a little bit because of this miniseries. And I think I read it retroactively, but one of the things that stood out on this reread of it, it's been a long time since I've read it, but the art in this one seems like John Byrne is really putting everything into this. Like, he's viewing this almost as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and so it's hyper-detailed. It's some of the best work, in my opinion, of John Byrne's career from an art perspective, really throughout, particularly in the opening issue, though, but throughout the entire thing, the consistency is remarkable from a guy who was known for his consistency. But it's a version of Superman that I think is iconic. The dimpled chin and the hair swoop and the muscular torso and everything. It was a very iconic Superman, but the way that he draws motion, the way that he draws Superman flying, I would argue has been as influential as any other Superman artist short of Kurt Swan in terms of how he depicts motion on the page. It's really incredible. Honestly, from beginning to end, I thought the artwork just popped off of this one, Nick.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, it's something we've talked about numerous times whenever we've dug back a little further, you know, into, I guess, what would you call this, Greg? The Bronze Age? Is that what people refer to it as?
I think it would be the end of the Bronze Age, the beginning of the modern. Yeah. I think people called it the Modern Age, but that almost doesn't work because now, you know, then what do you call the postmodern age?
Right, right. I guess my point is when we dig back, you know, 20 or 30 years to review some of the stories, you know, we always mention how the writing, just the style of writing has definitely evolved over the years, and it's a little jarring to us. But the one thing that we can say about some of these older books is that a lot of the art really holds up. And I think our modern perception of looking retroactively kind of depends on the art more than it does the writing, just because we're accustomed so much to this modern style of writing. And I got to say, from an art perspective, this absolutely holds up. It's colorful and poppy in a way that a lot of stuff isn't today. Like, it definitely looks like an 80s book, but it is among the best examples of 1980s style art that I've seen. The use of white space was great throughout. The use of thematic color, whether it be green on Krypton and red and yellows and Metropolis or what have you. It's all really good, and it lends itself to the story that Byrne is telling. So from an artistic perspective, big thumbs up in my book.
And one of the things that you're going to notice from listening to us, because of our age, because Nick's, of course, younger than I am, is we never really grew up reading, and I really haven't gone back and read a ton of 70s and early 80s Superman stories. So I'm not sure how much Byrne created or innovated in this from an artistic perspective, but I feel like I've read that this Krypton of John Byrne's was very different from what had come before. He kind of envisions Krypton as this sterile, emotionless planet, and we'll get to that in terms of the story, but just from an art perspective, I thought the depiction of Krypton, which we saw later in the movie Man of Steel,
yes,
very influenced by this,
yes,
but the kind of sharp, jagged edges to the buildings,
mm-hmm.
Almost this urban wasteland in the midst of this kind of desert-like planet at times. Very interesting from an architectural standpoint, a design standpoint, the way that he draws both Metropolis and Gotham City to be distinctly different from one another, mm-hmm. I thought was great.
I'm
gushing over the art here, but I was really blown away by how consistently good it was from beginning to end, and both in characters and in the settings and the architecture,
right,
in a way that sometimes gets overlooked in the modern era.
And the costume designs, especially during that early Krypton period, were just outstanding. Mm-hmm. From an artistic perspective, it's hard to find much of this to have any issues with. The Magpie isn't great, and for me personally, seeing Lex Luthor with the curly redheaded Hulk Hogan cut with the bald spot on the top was a little weird. But other than that, I really can't find too much to complain about.
I did appreciate how it helped me. It helped me establish the timeline, you know, because the time is kind of flying by during this miniseries at different rates.
Right.
But like, you see Lex when he first appears, and he's got this full, receding full head of red hair. And then the next time you see Lex, it's like a balding red hair. And then the next time you see Lex, it's almost completely gone. And just like you said, the Hulk Hogan around the sides, red hair. And it takes one hair. Seeing it to fruition as it completely falls out, because I think, Nick, that's something that both of us can relate to.
Indeed we can. And some of us just decided not to fight that battle anymore and end it on our own damn term.
That's a good point.
Unlike others.
I have to look at my hair and say, I'm sorry, I love you.
And then put it down. You got to do it, Greg. Put it out of its misery.
Nonetheless, so let's get to the basic story of this, and the layout, is that the word I'm looking for, Nick? The structure of the story?
Yeah.
It's a little bit different.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think the thing that was most interesting to me is when I hear six-issue miniseries these days, you imagine one story kind of stretched out across six issues. But here, back in this time frame, it was loosely connected in the idea of, it was just trying to establish all these familiar characters and concepts in a new context. But in terms of there being one main plot thread driving all six issues, there wasn't really. They kind of each were doing their own thing. And I gotta say, while it took me a little while to get used to, I ended up kind of really liking it, because it was a way for John Byrne to get through all the classic elements of the origin and have everything on the table by the end and kind of have it be both familiar and new at the same time. So, like, for example, by the end of this miniseries, you've got Clark at the planet with a pre-existing relationship with both Lois and Jimmy Olsen. They all of those Daily Planet characters have established rapport with one another. You're not watching that relationship build from the ground up. His relationship with Lex is clearly defined. His relationship with Lana is clearly defined. It really does move things along a lot faster than you would expect from a six-issue origin story, from the modern context anyway. So,
right.
Big fan.
Yeah, I agree. And it also it does things in a where you get the prologue where you see Krypton, and we'll get to that. We have to talk about that segment. you get the prologue that introduces Krypton, or Krypton, if you will. And but then after that, you see him land on Earth, and you fast forward to when he's in high school at 18 years old. And from issue 1 to issue 6, 10 years pass. And I have to say, that's another thing that I appreciated about Man of Steel, comparing it to the New 52, where they tried to condense things in a 5-year time frame, that because they wanted their heroes to be younger, I guess, was the idea. But it really limits what you can do and what you can cram in there and the reader. Because Man of Steel introduces – or spit it out, as it were. As the collective public eventually did.
Both are fine. Never mind. Let's blow past it.
That's another podcast for another time.
That's a talk and pop topic, probably.
Yes, I agree. Man of Steel.
Now you're all flustered.
I am. The Man of Steel, on the other hand, takes 10 years to, as you put it, Nick, kind of establish.
Greg, if the Lady Lara had a choice between spitting and swallowing, which one would she choose, and what would that sound like?
Well, Conrad, it would sound like, I don't give a fuck.
Maul.
I had nothing. I didn't know.
I think you know. Don't.
Well, that's not for me to discuss right now. But what is for me to discuss is the structure of this story, Conrad.
Why would we discuss the structure in a review when we can talk about... Never mind.
Well, it might sound something like Barry Windham in Ric Flair's hotel room in 1987.
Oh, okay. All right. Fair enough.
Or Tommy Rich. You know why Tommy Rich has no teeth, Nick?
Why is that?
Is it fell out?
Is it for the same reason that Tommy Young has no fingers?
Oh. Easy way or hard way.
We have done gone into popping ourselves mode. Okay, moving on. Finally, right. Story structure. Something about it.
Yeah, 10 years. 10 years. You have to establish Superman's relationships. Superman's the iconic stuff of what's his job? How does he get that job? What is his current status quo at the end and all that stuff? But I think 10 years gives you a chance to establish Superman as an icon and a champion of the people while showing who his oldest friends are versus who he's known, not quite as long as others versus when some of his iconic villains are first introduced, particularly Lex and Bizarro. So I really appreciated that and the approach to telling this sort of long-form origin story.
Yeah, I did as well. Like I mentioned earlier, that the whole concept of it – it felt almost trying to hit the high points rather than to draw a parallel. Part of the reason we chose the story was because you had read the origin story that's most near and dear to my heart, which is the first volume of Ultimate Spider-Man. And the two
by Brian Michael Bendis. About to take over Superman.
Yes, and the two from a standpoint could not be any more different. Like, Bendis is going to milk every single second of those first what feels like, a couple weeks of Spider-Man's career, whereas here Byrne is hitting the high points of like a 10-year period. And say, it worked for me because I think Superman, much like Batman or Spider-Man or certain other characters, it's one of those origins that we've kind of all been over so many times that there's only so much you can do with, the rocket crashing in the field. And granted, right, this back in 1985, that probably wasn't the case, but reading it now, I really appreciated that it didn't belabor certain points.
Right, yes. It showed you what it was changing, what was going to be different in terms of Krypton and its portrayal and the fact that the parents survive. But other than that, yeah, you don't need to see, a lot of the child stuff and backstory is told through flashbacks, brief flashbacks that might happen. But you don't really need to see that, you know, in this case. Like, it's not important. It's not what they're trying to do. They're trying to establish a new status quo for a Superman that a kid can pick up and he's Superman and not have to read how he becomes Superman. Because I think inherently to – at least to a kid, that's much less interesting than just seeing Superman go around and be Superman.
Right.
And it was I think that was a really bold choice. So the way they set this up, issue one is basically your bare basics. You get the birth on Krypton. You get and, of course, as I mentioned –
Well, not technically. Forward. That was one thing that was interesting.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Take it over, Nick.
Yeah, so like most versions of the Superman origin that I have seen, you know, he's born on Krypton in the final days of the planet – and then sent off to Earth. But in this one, it's a little different in that the impression I get, Greg, is that all of these children are birthed in like this birthing matrix chamber or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so his parents wind up removing him from that matrix, but he's still in like this protective bubble, almost like an artificial, you know, amniotic sac or whatever. And they actually launch him to Earth while he's still inside this bubble so that he actually comes out of the bubble and his first breaths are taken when he's fully self, you know, breathing on his own and without the support of this bubble. He's technically born on Earth based on at least the kind of birth that I understand happens on this version of Krypton.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. It is a bold and intentional decision to link Superman closer to his Earth origins than to his Kryptonian origins because he's, like you said, he is literally born on Earth, in Kansas, when he comes out of that bubble, and I think that was certainly a very different version. And for a lot of Superman diehards, that is a contention, a bone of contention. People that were really into Silver Age Superman, for instance, you know, Mark Waid always hated that aspect of it. But for me, I like it because it. I mean, it could go either way. It doesn't bother me if he's born on Krypton. It doesn't really matter to me either way. But I think it was something different and interesting that strengthens his bond to Earth and makes him really more of a human in some ways than he is an alien.
Yeah, and I'm not overly familiar with the stories that have followed, primarily Superman Birthright and Superman Secret Origin. But my understanding is this is the only version of the origin that's ever done anything like this.
I agree. I think so. I can't remember 100%, but I'm pretty sure that's correct. This was a wholly unique version of Superman's birth that I had never seen before and haven't seen since. Very, very different. And I think one of the other things that was done is the creation of, and I think heavily influenced by Superman the movie, the turning of Krypton into this cold, sterile, not cold because that's more of in the movie, but this sterile, emotionless, they're so far technologically advanced that they have forgotten their humanity.
Right.
They've forgotten their roots. And now it's
very emotionally sterile. Science. Emotionally sterile would be a good term to describe it because I think at one point Jor-El says to Lara, like, you know, the implication in that one scene, that's another thing. These scenes don't linger for very long. So you kind of got to pick up, you know, on the subtext of everything. But the implication is that they've been together, whatever, since that looks like on Krypton for a year, you know, for some extended period of time. And yet just now in the planet's closing moments is he actually confessing that he has true romantic feelings for her, that he actually loves her. The implication being that love is a feeling that isn't even, like, discussed or mm-hmm. openly admitted to here on this version of Krypton. So all this stuff, mm-hmm. and it plays out over the course of like 8 to 10 pages max. It's a really efficient, well done story that reveals a lot about what Byrne's vision of Krypton was.
And Jor-El even mentions when he's talking about Earth as a potential landing spot for baby Kal-El. He even mentions that Earth is almost like Krypton in its primitive years, as he refers to it, where they still understand emotions and things like love and where they still embrace that which we have denied ourselves have arrogantly denied ourselves. That's, I think, is how Jor-El puts it, where they even in his talking of this hilarious line about, from the moment I was first shown your hollow image and told your seed and mine would be mingled in the matrix, I have felt an unknown emotion stirring in my heart. And that basically implies they all arranged marriages on Krypton, that the only point of having a mate, quote unquote, is for reproduction. And then they go about their
But even their that, lives like, isn't really necessary. Because they're right. You know, their cells are just kind of placed together in this matrix. So, right. You know, the procreative act is not really necessary. I got the impression that it was more for traditional family unit and, like, child rearing than anything.
Mm-hmm. Right. Point. Yeah. Do you think this also raises the question? Do you think that it took until the end of the world for Jor-El to have his first boner?
No. I think he clearly had boners, as he mentioned. You know, a feeling stirring the first moment he. You know, they stirred in his heart, but that ain't all they stirred in.
He went to his chambers and studied on it for many hours.
Yes, his masturbatorium.
So that's there, but we've got to talk about, I think, the elephant in the room with regards to the Krypton portion of this. At one point, Jor-El is trying to sell Lara, I think would be a good way of putting it, on his plan for baby Kal-El to send him across the cosmos to survive the planet Krypton. And as he's doing this, he shows her images from Earth, of Earth's primitive inhabitants. And one of them is a young, strapping, shirtless Jonathan Kent tending his field at his farm. And Nick, Lara had a rather unique reaction to seeing Jonathan Kent half naked working on his farm.
She certainly did, and I wonder if they were to adapt this story in certain audio formats that may or may not be in the works for a future podcast. I wonder what that would sound like.
I don't know, Nick. Should we give him a taste of it now, or should we just hold off and wait for the grand debut?
Well, you're the maestro, as it were. I'm going to leave that decision up to you.
I think we'll sit on that for now. Aww. But I think we will mention that the term "naked hairy torso" is thrown around. Lara appears to nearly faint at one point.
And strangely enough, she calls Jor-El Norman for some reason, which I don't understand.
Yeah, it's very odd. Like, why is Jor-El Norman suddenly? I never quite understood that aspect of Man of Steel. Even as a youngster, even as a youngling, I always was like, where did the Norman come
Where's
in?
The Norman coming from?
And then there's these images that you see of Lara, and based on the lines that are drawn around her, it appears she's just shaking.
Constantly.
Shaking, just without being able to control herself.
What they don't reveal is that she was the Kryptonian tied into the Speed Force, and she was just vibrating at all fast frequencies at all times.
So clearly, things are getting a little hot and heavy in the chambers of Jor-El and Lara right before the planet explodes. So, the ultimate form of cock blocking, right, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. He was just about to make his move, and there the planet goes up in flames. I mean, God, you know. Of course, then again, what better way to spend your final moments than busting your first nut?
Yeah, but I just have a feeling that he didn't quite get to completion, you know. But what are we getting?
It wouldn't have taken very long.
What if people who are actually big fans of this book are listening to our podcast right now?
Well, you're a big fan of this book.
I am. I'm a huge fan of this book. Yeah, but I'm sure they might not appreciate our talk of masturbatoriums and whatnot. But nonetheless, if you're a long time listener, this show is at this point. It's just an excuse for us to throw out our jokes that really are only good to ourselves, and that's fine. Quite frankly, now we see Clark on Smallville, and this is something that we've actually seen play out in various adaptations of Superman over the years, which is Superman using his powers and his abilities to be a star on the gridiron in high school. This is something they actually explored on Smallville as well, to great effect, where Clark is just dominating everyone in a Herschel Walker-like fashion, Nick.
I appreciate your attempt to placate me there, sir.
I did. I thought I'd throw you a bone there. You know, the greatest college football player of all time.
You say in sarcastic fashion.
No, no, that wasn't sarcastic.
Oh my God, I'm not even going to breathe. This, no, never mind. We're moving on.
What do you mean?
I used to
troll you the way that you used to troll me about the Patriots going undefeated in 2007. And how'd that turn out? Turned out pretty good, didn't it?
Move on.
Herschel Walker, dominant athlete. Not a bad mixed martial artist either, actually.
He's only fought twice, but he beat the ever-living hell out of those two jobs.
The fire out of them. Now, here's the question. Herschel was it?
Who fucking knows? Who knows? But I hope if that's going to be the result, I hope each one of his personalities gets a fight at some point, because that shit was entertaining. he took that man down and beat him about the head and neck area until he submitted because of strikes.
The man's what, in his 50s, and he looks like he's in like 25 or something. That's ridiculous.
Let's see. He would have been 18 in 1980. 19 in 1980. So whatever the math on that is. So 38 years. So he's pushing 60 at this point.
Wow, incredible. He wouldn't be a bad Jor-El.
No.
But
he could play all the Kryptonians as various personalities.
Oh, good Lord. That's true. He abused, but of course we get the famous trope of Superman abusing his powers early in his life to become a star on the football field. And of course that leads to the lecture from Pa Kent and the explanation to Clark that he was adopted and they found him in a rocket ship. So we get all of this in the first issue, and then from there you see how his various abilities developed. You know, he learned about his flying and his heat vision, and they tell all this through flashbacks. And you also get his first venture out in the world when he comes to the realization after he learns of his origins that, you know, he needs to use his abilities to help others instead of help himself. And that he needs to leave Smallville behind because the bigger problems are faced in the big city, basically. And he goes off to Metropolis, and one of the interesting aspects of this is when he first goes out, he doesn't have a costume. He goes out and he saves this experimental space shuttle that introduces us to Lois Lane for the first time, and also introduces us to the captain of the space shuttle, who I think will have a very good casting choice when the time comes, if this is ever edited into, you know, let's say an audio version or a radio version or some kind, Nick.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this scene here, you know, where we meet Lois Lane for the first time, it kind of reminded me of the airplane sequence from Star Returns a little bit.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, I think it was a huge influence on that scene. That in and of itself, it may be the highlight of that movie in some ways. It's a pretty good sequence. And in this one, yeah, you meet Lois for the first time, and he makes the save. And he had already been making saves around the world, helping to stop things and kind of staying hidden from sight. But here, he makes the mistake of getting caught out in public, and it leads to one of my favorite scenes in the whole book, and one of... I think one of the most iconic Superman scenes of the 80s, which is that shot where, you know, you cut back to Smallville and Ma and Pa Kent are in their house, and it's late at night, and they hear a rumbling upstairs going on. They think someone's breaking in, and they bust into Clark's room, and there he is, kind of sitting in shadow, like almost a really dark and kind of scary scene in a way, as you see that he's Clark and he's sitting there just like, you know, hands folded, staring down in the darkness. And he says, they all wanted a piece of me. Every one of them, they came after me and they all wanted a piece of me. And he's like, I tried to help them and they all wanted a piece of me, you know, and it's this classic. And again, I thought very influential on the movie Man of Steel. a little bit of that, because there's a scene in Man of Steel where he goes back and he visits his mom and basically tells her the same thing, that, you know, I thought I could be this beacon for people, and now they're out there and they won't leave me alone. I can't have a life, basically. And I think it's one of the best scenes in the book. I absolutely love it. And it also leads to the creation of the iconic Superman costume, which in John Byrne's version is designed by Martha, and basically a design, and the S stands for Superman, not for Hope. And as she designs the suit, they explain that in John Byrne overly technical fashion, that the suit is protected by an invulnerable aura that surrounds Clark at all times. So if it's skin tight clothing, it'll be protected the way that his skin is. But anyway, yeah. What did you make of that whole sequence, Nick? The going out into the world without a costume or an identity, and then returning to Smallville and the transition into Supermanery.
Well, I especially like the idea that, you know, this was not his first rodeo. Another thing kind of lifted for the film Man of Steel is you see Ma Kent keeping a scrapbook there of all these different crises that have been averted over the years, and the implication there being that Clark has gone out and accomplished a lot of things over the years. And so this is interesting when they finally have him exposed in the way they choose to do it, and how emotionally vulnerable they show Clark to be, which is, you know, one of the reasons why I've never been as high on Superman as you have, is I am one of the people who sometimes struggles to find the relatability in there. But I think moments like these, where you show that he is, you know, flawed and does have fears in some way, I think that only helps to grow him and to humanize him and to help him to forge a connection with a wider audience. So I absolutely dug this bit.
I agree. And that's, I think that what you said is kind of the key to why this version of Superman works so well for me, is that it is a grounded Superman in many ways. I mean, yes, he's invulnerable. He can move faster than a speeding bullet. He's the strongest hero on the planet. He can do, you know, he can do so many things, but you're not seeing him go around bouncing planets around. You're not seeing him travel backwards through time or whatever. And you're not seeing a Superman who is perfect in every way. You're seeing a Superman who is a good person trying to do the right thing as best he can. And he screws up along the way. You know, he screws up with Lana. He screws up, you know, when he goes to Metropolis the first time. He screws up with Batman and misunderstands him. He makes mistakes along the way, but it's always in the guise of trying to do the right thing and having a strong moral compass. And I think that scene in particular was key to showing his vulnerabilities. I think throughout the book, you see that Byrne almost makes a particularly focused effort to show that Superman or Clark has the same exact desires that we do. You know, he kind of lusts after Lois. He wants to be a hotshot reporter. You know, he wants to he wants to have some sort of achievement in addition, and he wants to have his alone time. You know, he even mentions at one point, I can't be Superman 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I need time to relax and to decompress. And I think that that's a subtle thing to put in there, but an important thing to put in there to establish this is a different Superman than we've seen before. And I really like that concept of a Superman who isn't able to just seamlessly juggle every aspect of his life. So that was pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah, I liked it as well. Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what else to say. It, pretty much everything that they're doing here, the differences from the classically accepted version of the character, picking up what they're laying down, pretty much everything in this book.
Now, issue two is interesting because in this trade, issue two basically gives you the Lois dynamic with Superman. And we also introduce ourselves to Perry White, the managing editor of the Daily Planet. Although he's got a Perry White. Mm-hmm. We introduce ourselves to Perry White. And he has a very brief role, really. He's not in this book a whole lot. But you do see him here as Lois. is assigned to get the full story on Superman, and I really liked the sequence over the next few pages where she's constantly trying to – she's so confident she's going to get this interview with Superman, but everywhere she follows him, she's just a little bit too late. And there's a nice sequence of panels that I thought was pretty creatively designed that shows her in different outfits on different days just missing out on Superman doing these incredible heroic feats. And eventually she has a pretty devious Lois Lane way to trick Superman into saving her, which is that she fakes driving her car into the river, and Superman has to go and save her, thinking he's had an accident. And of course, actually, the reveal at the end is that he saw that she had a copy of the Jethro Tull song Aqualung.
Hey, Aqualung.
Underneath her seat, in case he wasn't able to get there. But he goes in, he saves her, and even though she's tricked him, he's so smitten with her that he basically doesn't even let on that he knew until the end of the interview. Goes back to her apartment, waits for her to change into something a little more comfortable, and then does an interview with her. But and this is interesting because depending on I guess you could argue that Lois had it coming, given her rather underhanded way of trying to get an interview. But she gets to the Daily Planet only to realize that the newest employee, Clark Kent, has already scooped her on the Superman story. Which, what did you make of that, Nick? Dick move on Superman's part or fair retaliation for Lois's stunt?
I don't know. I don't think it's either. You know, I don't know that it was a retaliatory thing. I took it as Clark just, like, genuinely not understanding that she would be pissed about it. I took it as him, you know, trying to work his way into this position where, you know, he could do the most good, where he would hear about things that were going wrong, you know, or to be a reporter of the Daily Planet, and him just being so naive that he didn't understand that it was going to cause issues, essentially.
Now, Nick, are you suggesting that Lois Lane might have looked more into what Clark did than Clark intended?
Yes. Yes, I am suggesting that.
A story as old as on itself. what else? We get to issue three. I definitely want to get your thoughts on, because this fast forwards just a little bit. Superman's been operating in the public eye for a little while, and we actually open up not with Superman as our point of view character, but with Batman as our point of view character, as we open in Gotham City and see a young Batman with the original Batman costume still, the traditional Batman costume with no yellow oval, which was the official costume at the time in DC Comics. This is clearly a younger Batman with just the bat symbol on his chest, which is, by the way, still my favorite Batman costume, and I wish it was still in the comics. I thought this opening was awesome in particular.
Yeah, I don't remember the opening. Remind me.
So you open it in a Gotham City alley, and there's this random thug running down the alley as you start the issue. And his name is Bull, I think. And he's running from something, and it's terrifying. And the next thing you see is this, like, the shadowy figure of Batman, like, trounces on top of him. And then Batman just essentially threatens to hurt him so severely that he'd wish he were dead. And it's pretty badass.
Yeah, this is a good opening. I just looked at it again. I agree with you. I dig this costume design for Batman as well. Byrne draws a hell of a Batman, no doubt about that. But really, what I liked from this whole issue was the dynamic there is pretty – you know, they're not – mutual respect between the two isn't quite there yet, but just – that slight tension that undercuts every interaction, every line of dialogue comes through. And so I really wound up enjoying this as well. I bumped up against the plot device at first when Batman said that he was going to kill an innocent. I kind of went, I kind of cringed a little bit. But then the ultimate reveal that they go with, that he was going to kill himself, essentially. Man, he has a lot of faith in Superman, I have to say.
Yeah.
You know,
hey, you know, Batman's always a step ahead of the curb, right? Good thing it wasn't Bizarro, right?
Yeah, if it had been Bizarro, he'd have been fucked.
Well, fucked. But I agree. Interesting, you mentioned that tension, and that's very much a John Byrne creation as far as I know, because I think prior to what you saw in Dark Knight Returns and what you see in Man of Steel, Batman and Superman had, for the most part, been presented as best buddies over the years. You know, smiling, laughing, hands on hips and all that stuff. You've read the early Justice League issues.
Mm-hmm.
This was kind of, I think, exploring an idea that Frank Miller had that Byrne shared, which is that by their very natures, these two wouldn't get along at first. That they would have that Superman had an issue with the way that Batman does things. And then what Byrne does to kind of turn away from Miller's ultimate realization of that is by having Superman kind of acknowledge that, you know what, I'm naive. I thought I knew what crime was. I thought I knew what destitution was until I got to Gotham City. And you know what, Bruce? You know what, Batman? You can have it. You can have your Gotham City. I'm going back to Metropolis, which I think is an interpretation of these characters that influenced the animated series and subsequently influenced all the comics that came and influenced us as a generation of Batman and Superman fans to come to expect to, yes, currently we have them as friends and a respect between one another. But I think when I was a young kid, this was the dynamic, which is there is a little bit of maybe not distrust because they respect one another, but just tension, just like, you know, they're not best buddies. They don't really understand the other's world because Batman can't relate to being as naive as Superman is, and Superman can't relate to being as cynical and jaded as Batman is.
Right.
So I thought it was a really good issue, one of the best in the series. And we get introduced to the character that we mentioned earlier of Magpie,
yes,
a.k.a. Margaret Pie.
Oh, I wonder who's going to get that prestigious role in any future audio adaptations.
You know, that's a great question, Nick. I feel like it's really up in the air. It could go to anyone at this point. What's funny is I think the I had heard like just passing mention of Magpie before.
Yes, I'm not even. I gotta admit, after my years of reading Batman comics, I don't know that I'd ever actually read one that had Magpie in it. I just knew that she existed.
Yes, exactly. Same here. And I think where you may remember the name from is probably where I most remember it from, which is in, if you remember Jeff Loeb's first arc of Superman Batman, there's a scene where Superman's been hit with a kryptonite bullet and Batman's trying to help him to the cave so that he can operate on him, basically. And on their way there, he's trying to get Superman to talk to keep him awake, basically. And Superman says something like, "Hey, remember Magpie?" And Bruce says something to the effect of, "The criminal." And Superman goes, "Do you know anyone else ever named Magpie?" This is a pretty good callback. And this was in 2003, I think. So
yeah, so this would have still been the origin as of 2003,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Absolutely it was. Very very unique. Did it not feel like she's a little bit of a 60s Batman villain?
No, very much, especially with the costume and like the ridiculous headpiece and stuff. Yeah, very much.
And even the dialogue, you know, blast, yeah, blast, blast, stuff like that. But overall, I thought this was really, really good, and I appreciated the especially the cute little line at the end from Batman's thought bubble where he's like, "Who knows, in a different universe or in a different world, we might have been friends." Pretty good. Page 4 introduces us to Lex, and this is another huge change.
Yes,
to the Superman mythos.
Lex Luthor is essentially Woody Harrelson in Indecent Proposal, not Woody Harrelson, the other guy. What's his name?
Yeah, Redford. Robert Redford. Yeah. Yeah, that guy. The hell did that guy ever do? Who'd he ever beat?
Did you know, Greg, that Abdul the Butcher beat Killer Khan, Bruiser Brody, and
Stan Hansen? I heard that somewhere. And you know, Nick, I don't make a lot of requests of you. I don't think.
Oh God, I don't.
But I would like very much for you to gig me like the Butcher.
Oh, maybe one day I'll, in the privacy of the L-shaped studios, once the bed is fixed in the corner, I'll gig you like the butcher.
So, but this the actual change here is, yes, you see Lex Luthor transformed from, okay, the Silver Age Super Friends Lex Luthor, the mad scientist with the green suit who flies around and fights Superman and comes up with increasingly dastardly traps and whatnot that are of his own making, is reimagined here in the mid-80s. And as I understand it, this was a bit of a Marv Wolfman idea that John Byrne kind of extrapolated on. But they basically re-envision Lex as what most of us know Lex as today, a ruthless, evil tycoon businessman. And this was a complete innovation. They changed Lex around to make him one of the, as it mentions here in the dialogue, one of the three richest men in the world. They don't say who the other two are, but I'm assuming one would be Bruce Wayne, and don't know who the other would be. They establish him as the richest man in the world, one of the most powerful men in the world, and somebody who, rather than being a, quote, mad scientist, is really just a, I mean, let's be honest, a oh, I don't know if I should go there, Nick.
But oh, go there.
Shares traits with some individuals who may have been rich in the 80s and later gone on to political office. Trump's who I'm referring to.
Which, I was about to say, which really is kind of hard to pick up on who you're talking about, considering that very few rich people have ever gone into politics.
Right, never happens. But yes, there's a lot of Donald Trump elements there. There's this kind of art of the deal guy who just thinks he can buy everyone. Everyone's going to be on his payroll. It's the version of Lex that we've seen in every adaptation since Lois and Clark, Smallville, except Superman Returns. Oh, that's another story. Even Batman v Superman with the weird version they did. The animated series, of course, all the comics. And once again, as we've said with a lot of these changes, it is a huge improvement to Lex Luthor. It is a prototype of a character that makes sense as an enemy for Superman in the modern era, and also creates him as a potential larger DC Universe villain. Nick, I believe that you're a fan of corporate Lex Luthor.
I absolutely a massive fan, although I will say that at least initially in this version, we don't get to see as much of the intellect and cunning that we would later see in stuff like Justice League or Superman the Animated Series or what have you. It's more of the foundation for where I'm assuming that Byrne probably worked her eventually to provide him with some of that menace and edge to him. A random aside, Greg, when's the last time you've actually seen Indecent Proposal ever?
I probably saw it back in, like, high school.
Why did you not tell me that Rip Taylor was in it?
I don't remember that. I don't know that I have ever seen it then, because I don't remember Rip Taylor being in that movie. I must have seen it on TV, because I remember...
I made the mistake of clicking on the, the Wikipedia.
Of course I can see him. He's a half-naked Indian, for God's sake.
I am going to send this to you via Facebook Messenger, and our delightful audience will get to hear your reaction. This is the kind of hard-hitting comic book analysis you come to us for. Let's see here. Let's see. There he is. Boom.
Look at his hair. I mean, his toupee.
Folks, if you want to experience it, go to Wikipedia and type in Rip Taylor. And
amazing.
See it for yourself. Amazing. Sorry, continue with whatever you were talking about.
Absolutely worth it. I don't know how to regain myself after that. Good Lord.
I don't know that you can. Lex, foundation for the character that he would eventually become in many various versions of Superman-adapted media, but not a lot in common with wacky real estate tycoon, mad scientist, kooky 60s and 50s Lex.
Basically, this is a Lex who is going to hurt Superman without ever getting his dirty.
Right.
He's gonna use minions. He's gonna use whatever is at his disposal. So issue 5 is kind of interesting in that it introduces a character that I think David Sunday will be getting very familiar with, and Dr. Ting. Oh, I bopped you with that one.
Woo! That's good stuff right there now. Yeah, go ahead, talk some more.
So we meet Dr. Ting, who is Lex's chief scientist, and he creates an imperfect Superman
clone. I can hear the not at all Chinese accent in my head. Okay.
And this is our introduction to new version of Bizarro, which is an imperfect clone of Superman who does not share a lot of the classic Bizarro ideas of, you know, talking funny and backwards S and all that stuff.
Not a comedic character at all, at least presented in this context.
Presented as really a tragic character.
Yeah, a tragic character, kind of a little bit of a Frankenstein's monster kind of thing, and mostly just, you know, the first example in this miniseries of a legitimate physical threat to Superman. So more of something in the you know, parasite, or not quite Doomsday, but just one of those Superman villains that is really just there for the bulk about him. So I don't know. Do you know if they got into some of the more classic Bizarro stuff later with him?
They eventually would by the mid-90s, but I think it might have taken that long to get there. I think they did bring a version of Bizarro back, and kind of they were playing around with the idea that he, even though it was a complete artificial creation, that he was starting to feel something, you know, like the implication that Superman gave that he actually sacrificed himself because he would help Lois's sister Lucy regain her vision. Which, that's one weird thing, by the way. I didn't get the Lucy Lane being blind subplot.
Well, especially considering they hadn't introduced Lucy prior to this. Like, all of a sudden there's just a blind woman in Lois's apartment, and you're kind of, yeah.
I mean, I guess we have done some research to see if there was anything around this time that had her in it, but I'm going to pose it to the listening audience, Todd, Tim, whoever may have information. Is this something that happened in the Legends event, which I've never read, or is this just something that happened offhand?
But wasn't this like a mini, like a relaunching of the character? So
yeah,
were there even Superman books that would have been in this continuity going on at the time?
That's a good point. I don't know why. I think Legends might have been like, I don't know what, I think Legends is one of those weird, like, it may have taken place in like the first year of superheroes or something. I don't know. I we'll need to do that one at some point in the future. But yeah, I don't know when it could have been, Nick, because I was just taken aback by when somebody threw chemicals in her face. That's established, by the way, in the story.
She's essentially Daredevil.
Right. Someone had thrown chemicals in her face, and Bizarro's dissolving body is able to reverse the chemical effects or whatever and give her sight back. Very bizarre. I mean, that's a bizarre subplot. Anyway, but I was like, did I miss something here? Like, very weird, I thought.
Yeah, I didn't get it either. So yeah, that's issue 5. Issue 6, what exactly? I'm trying to remember.
Issue 6 was his return to Smallville.
Ah, yes. This was good.
This was good. He encounters the hologram of Jor-El, which he doesn't know what to make of at first. And this is where he ends up gaining all of the knowledge it instantly added into his brain, all this knowledge of where he's from, who his parents were, and the entire basic history of Krypton. The way that in Superman the movie he finds out from the crystals, you know, he finds out all of this just through his encounter with the ghost, so to speak, of Jor-El. He also comes face to face with Lana, and she kind of explains a dangling thread from the very first issue when he learned about his powers and his origins a little bit, and that he was adopted, and he tells his parents, there's someone I have to see first. And we finally see that pay off here in issue 6 and see his interactions with Lana. I thought this was a really strong issue, and it ends with a blatant, and I'm not going to deny this, this is my favorite version of Superman, because at the end of the issue, and maybe it's a little too harsh, it is dismissal of Krypton, but he basically says, I don't consider myself a Kryptonian. I consider myself an Earthman. This is where I was born. This is where I've lived my life. So to me, while I'll always be appreciative of Krypton and what my birth parents gave to me and did for me, they're not my real parents, and they're not my real story. I'm an American, I'm an Earthman, and I'm Superman or whatever. So I thought this was a really great issue from beginning to end.
Yeah, especially Doug, you know, them, you know, as someone who's never been a huge Superman fan, and who's only read certain eras of the character or certain issues of the character, most, I would say like 90, no, virtually 100% of all the Superman I've ever read has had Lois Lane as the love interest. And so I've never understood the Lana character or really what she was all about. And I thought this issue kind of set that dynamic up in a very, in a perfect way, like made me understand the distinction between the two and why he had a connection with her and why she would still be relevant to him all these years later. So yeah, I loved this sixth issue. I loved the entire thing in general. Rare for me to find a Superman book that I can say I unequivocally loved, but this was outstanding from beginning to end.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that, man. This was your first time ever reading it, and it's my first time reading it in a long time, but it's the book that set the template for my fandom of Superman as a character because of all the great creators that followed. And, you know, one thing I should mention, you know, if you're familiar with reading modern comics, let's say you're a big fan of the current Superman books, and you say, well, I've never even heard of this. Let me go back and read it. We kind of mentioned this earlier on, but you do have to take certain things, you know, just for granted. It's going to be wordy because comics back then were much more wordy.
It's going to move at a faster pace than you're probably accustomed to.
Much faster pace. And John Byrne in particular probably picked some of the habits of his old cohort, Chris Claremont, loves word balloons, like all over the place word balloons. So there's going to be a lot of talking. A lot of talking out loud and a lot of thought bubbles. Thought bubbles, another thing that you don't see in modern comics, but they're all over the place here. And that's the style that comics had for the bulk of their history until the 90s, really, or the late 80s. So you see, you're going to get a lot of wordiness. You're going to get, and the other thing, kind of a quirk of John Byrne that actually our friend Tim kind of pointed out to me that I had not really thought about, but John Byrne loves to get into the technicalities of things. And sometimes it's helpful, but like I'll give you one example. The Superman shaving scene is wordier than it needs to be. Wouldn't you agree?
It is, but at the same time, it answers one of those like wacky fan questions, you know?
Yep. And he's like, I'll use the reflection to adjust the right thing and singe the hair off of my chinny chin chin. I made that part up. But just imagine that it was written that way. But no, so there are some things in here that will be dated, some things that, you know, won't hold up well. But I think all, you know, if you can get past the sort of fact that you're reading an older comic, I think the ideas presented here and the themes presented here show that comics were moving in a more mature direction, especially if you compare this, Nick, to some of the very early Green Lantern, Green Arrow issues that we would on the show. You can see the impact that those comics have had on DC Comics in the years that followed, and now we're seeing this sort of dividing line between the old way of comics and the way of creating comics evolve for years to come from this. So I think it's a nice cross section there, and I think it holds up, as you said, Nick. I think it holds up really well for the most part. I think the ideas presented here are almost all really strong. Whether or not they're your preferred version of Superman, that's up for you to decide. But I think if you give this a read, I think that you'll enjoy it, and I think that you'll see, hopefully, maybe that you've taken this for granted. Because in all likelihood, if you're a modern Superman fan, the version that you've kind of grown into was at the very least influenced by this book and maybe completely shaped in some ways by this book.
Epic Baba.
So there you have it. The rare Superman book that Nick has almost unadulterated praise for. Anything that you wanted to point out that we've missed on this one?
Not that I can think of, no. I was really taken aback by how much I enjoyed this. So, big ones for me.
Awesome. Good to hear. Well, we want to hear your thoughts on John Byrne's The Man of Steel. Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Join the newly redesigned Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Come in there and join the conversation. Tell us your thoughts on this one. You can email us, GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. Let us know your thoughts on Superman. What are your thoughts on some of the changes that were introduced in Man of Steel? Were they for the better? Were they for the worse? Do you like the Kents alive? Do you like them dead? Let us know, folks. And in the meantime, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will have even more hard-traveling fanboy action for you.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, and NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, it is me, the manager, Todd Weber, and I'm here to tell you all about a brand new show on the PTBN Pop feed. It's Talkin' Pop. Each month, hosts Jennifer Smith and Tim Capel discuss the hottest topics in pop culture along with their special guests. Funny, illuminating, and even sometimes a bit naughty, Talkin' Pop is our latest and greatest legendary Place to Be Nation podcast. So be sure to join Jenny and Tim every single month on Talkin' Pop, proudly part of the PTBN Pop feed on iTunes, Stitcher, and PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back here in the L-shaped studios, where we still mourn the loss of career of Ho-Ho Loon.
Mm. Why you got to bring the temperature of the room down, Greg?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be so heavy. I already mentioned Tommy Rich has no teeth, so I thought I should kind of piggyback on that with some more bad news about Ho-Ho Loon still not being employed by World Wrestling Entertainment.
Mm.
Our ticker hasn't even been taken out of the closet for what? Damn near a year at this point, right? And it's 6 months
it's
at least.
It's been far too long. Far too long, in my opinion. But somewhere
out there. You
know
what we need, though? You know what we need? And like you said, like you were implying there, somewhere out there, Ho-Ho is another chance. I feel it. But what we need in his place is a Rip Taylor ticker.
No. Now, but he's dead.
Is he?
I'm fairly sure.
Oh, my.
I don't know that.
Now who's taking the temperature of the room down, Nick?
He's dead.
Passing American icon, Rip Taylor.
He's dead. No, I guess he's still alive.
Excellent news. He should be in the MCU.
Oh, he'd be Uatu the Watcher.
Uatu, yes.
He's 83 years young.
And looking every day of it.
Oh, here's an even better one. I'm going to send this one to you now.
Oh, no.
Oh, here we go. Here it is.
I'm making myself. Oh! What on earth? He looks so deceitful, like he's pulling a surprise.
Oh my god, he should play Mixlipidalic in the Man of Steel sequel.
Perfect, sold, sold. That's amazing. That is absolutely amazing. At the least, he can be one of Mixie's forms. You know.
Yes. I'm good with this. We are wildly off topic once more.
We should get going because we're going to get right into a loaded edition of Reading and Watching.
Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching?
Ah. What you been reading and watching?
Now, Nick, I have not read any new comics this week, although I did buy many, but... that's beside the point, because you have read a new comic this week.
So, yeah, the only book I read this week was the free, well, 25 cents in print, free digitally, DC Nation number 0 that DC Comics put out. They kind of put this out. It's really weird the way they did it. I this would easily fit as a free comic book day offering, but they decided to do it the Wednesday before Free Comic Book Day. I don't know why exactly, but anyway, basically it's a snippet of where the three big titles in the DCU are going in over the coming months. That's a little preview of Batman, a little preview of Superman, a little preview of Justice League. And so the Batman story, with written by Tom King, art from Clay Mann, involves the Joker awaiting impatiently his invitation to the wedding of the century between Batman and Catwoman. And I don't really want to say anything more than that, because I don't want to spoil how the scene plays out for those people who haven't read it yet. But it, I will say, in the course of this little short story, erased all of my concerns about Tom King writing the Joker in a new story. You know, I was not a huge fan of his take on the character in War of Jokes and Riddles, which I really enjoyed that story overall, but just didn't like his take there. He seems to have fixed all that, and Clay Mann draws a hell of a terrifying Joker, in my opinion.
Now, I do have a question. Do you think that this could be setting up a match made in heaven and a match made in hell?
One can only hope. One can only hope. I just hope Batman gets married in something as flamboyant as the Macho Man Randy Savage did at SummerSlam. But in any event, moving on to Superman, this had, I believe, art from
Jose Luis García López, right? Oh,
yes, that name. And it was written, of course, by Brian Michael Bendis. And this one is almost like the complete opposite of the little Bendis and Jim Lee story we got in Action Comics 1000, whereas, you know, that story was almost entirely action-based. This story is almost entirely Daily Planet-focused, giving you an idea of how Bendis is going to write Perry White and Jimmy Olsen and Clark Kent. It very much showed me what I had kind of seen along in that Bendis is going to be phenomenal at the planet stuff. it is the Superman stuff that I have a larger concern about. And I will say, you know, we have to wait and see where it goes and see where it plays out. But there is a plot point that is only vaguely hinted around about, but is unaddressed as to what the actual dynamic is, that will probably have you especially very concerned about what Bendis is planning for the characters. And that's all I'll say there. And then finally, Justice League, No Justice, a little snapshot of Scott Snyder and I forget who's doing the art on him with that, but
Chung, right?
Chung, yeah, a little snapshot of their Justice League run that's upcoming, and this one almost doesn't feel like a setup for Scott Snyder's book so much as it does a setup for the entire Justice League line in general, where you see all these different characters that you wouldn't expect to interact, like whether it's Deathstroke or Sinestro or Starro the Conqueror, or just all these crazy characters interacting with all the various heroes of the DC Universe for reasoning that makes some level of sense if you've read Metal, you know, regardless of your feelings on that. But it was cool to see the Justice League split off into like these tactically based teams, you know, with Superman leading a team and Batman leading a team and Wonder Woman leading a team and Cyborg leading a team, all focused on different missions, all focused on different strengths they could bring to the table. Yeah, I really enjoyed this, and it made me look forward to Snyder's Justice League run a little bit more than I was beforehand, seeing as how I was not wowed or bowled over by Metal by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, of course, his JL run is spinning directly out of Metal. So, ultimately, enjoyed all these stories, but I thought the Batman story was a clear runaway winner for me.
Very good. I've actually already downloaded the free issue on Comixology and have read through a little bit of it at work before I went to lunch today, or attempted to go to lunch. And I'm looking forward to finishing the issue at some point. So I'll have my thoughts hopefully next week on the show. So let's move from there on to watching. And where do you want to begin, Nick? You want to begin with the DC shows, or do you want to begin to the...
That's up to you. You're the driver of the steership.
I believe that the main event should be the strongest possible match on the card. And so I'm going to wait, and we're going to start off with the CW shows, which continue to be on quite the roll. Now, I am very behind on Black Lightning, Nick. I have not watched the finale yet.
And I didn't give my thoughts on the finale because I'm waiting on you. So we'll punt that ball down the road.
I hope to be able to catch up, and maybe tomorrow night I'll have a chance to do a little bit of that. But anyway, so – and I'm also behind on Supergirl. So I will let you give your thoughts on Supergirl, though.
Yeah, very briefly. I've watched the two episodes since the return. Enjoyed them both, although I will say the wins – the Toy Man focused episode I wasn't overly high on, just because I thought Laurie Metcalf as Wynn's mom was a bad casting choice, and she gave a piss-poor performance. But other than that, I've dug the furthering of the new status quo between Kara and Mon-El. I've enjoyed the subplots that involve Lena and what she's up to. I've really enjoyed both of these episodes. I thought they were among the strongest ones yet, and the show has also introduced a heartbreaking new subplot with the reveal that John Jones's father, who he's only recently rescued from Mars, is suffering from dementia and is slowly losing control of his mental faculties. So, digging all this stuff that Supergirl's putting down to this point.
Yes, I did enjoy the dementia reveal. I watched the Wynn episode, and that caught me off guard and was really, really touching. And I continue to be interested in how that plot will resolve itself. So let's move on to Tuesday night and The Flash. And this one is really ramping up more of the DeVoe focus. And in particular, this one was picking up the heels of the death of a very important character to the team the week before. And this episode was all about how Barry reacts to that death. And at first, he doesn't. He tries to lock it away and ignore it and move on as best he can. He learns over the course of this episode that he really can't do that. That he can't move on until he actually accepts what happened and grieves over his lost friend. And so we also get the return of Captain Cold, at least a former Captain Cold, as this is Citizen Cold, coming over from Earth X. Leo Snart comes back to help the team as they're trying to foil by DeVoe to steal the nuclear bomb man that we saw earlier this year. And I don't know what his real name is. That's what I'm calling it. Fallout, I think, is his name, right?
Yes, Fallout is the code name they give him.
So DeVoe wants Fallout. And in the midst of Citizen Cold from Earth-X, they also unfortunately get a version of your favorite character and mine, Laurel Lance. And this version is a Nazi version of Laurel Lance, so even less likable than usual. Although I will say she's much more tolerable in villain form than in hero form. And so overall, I thought this was really good. But I think what really worked in this episode was Snart's return, the dynamic between Harry and Sisko, and really kind of a little bit touching now relationship between Caitlin and her alter ego, Killer Frost, and especially the performance from Grant Gustin was just awesome here. As someone who is trying to repress his feelings as best he can, and then to see how he actually grieves and has a really touching moment with Joe as well, which I thought was awesome, because we don't get a lot of Joe and Barry heart-to-heart moments anymore, and that was really cool to see. I thought it was a really good episode, Nick.
Yeah, I would agree. Enjoyed pretty much everything about it. I thought especially it was interesting to see DeVoe slip for once. He'd been perpetually, 10 steps ahead of our heroes the entire season. So to finally show that emotion and his lack of understanding it may be his ultimate undoing is kind of what they seem to be hinting around about. So I dug especially the DeVoe subplots here. So, yes, totally. Very, very good episode of The Flash, agreed.
And kudos to DeVoe for having the willpower to turn down the advances of his wife.
Yes, kudos to him. And especially, I would think with his newfound last powers, he would want to experiment a little. But,
Right. I mean, but to each their own. Quite frankly, it's not for us to say.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's got their own views. Maybe he doesn't want to experiment in that way. That's fine. I'd do it all night long, quite frankly. Me and Cowboy and Austin. Getting all hot and bothered. Let's move on to Thursday and Arrow, which brings us to Oliver Queen's now one-man mission to take out Ricardo Diaz, who has seized control of Star City, seemingly on every level from the top down. And we also get a boring and uninteresting subplot of Renee and his, what would you say, performance anxiety as he gets back out in the field after his injury.
I would say that I barely remember it because I stopped paying attention because I just didn't care.
Yes, very boring stuff about character no one cares about, talking to other characters no one cares about in the form of Curtis and unfortunately Dinah. And I was really upset that Renee's daughter tries to talk him into staying superhero. That was very disappointing. And perhaps Diaz needs to make a visit to that household. But all that being said, that's actually a very small, minor part of the episode because most of it revolved around Oliver and his relationship with Anatoly.
Yeah, it did. And that was good. Yeah. It was a breath of fresh air to get to see these two kind of start to become on the same page once again. I think for so long we had seen them be antagonistic towards each other, whether it was, starting last season and then stretching into this season or what have you. But to see them start to regain some of that undeniable bond and some of the chemistry those two characters have had over the course of the show was a welcome change. Although I am highly concerned about the future of Anatoly as it relates to his survival on the show.
Yes, I would assume that Diaz is going to discover that Anatoly's feelings for Oliver have thawed a little bit, and that's not going to sit well. I thought Diaz was awesome again in this episode, as he has been consistently, and Stephen Amell continues to put out incredible performances week in and week out. And in this case, this episode was really the most memorable part of it anyway, was an all-time great fight scene for Arrow between Oliver and Diaz. And Nick, I know we were talking off there, one aspect of this incredible fight that that you liked in particular.
Yeah, the idea that you know, Ollie beat him, essentially. You know, it. Mm-hmm. The predictable thing to have done would have been for Diaz to win the fight fair and square, and Ollie have to be humiliated and then build the rematch. But instead, they made it clear that from a hand-to-hand perspective, Ollie has got the upper hand on Diaz, and that Diaz was only able to beat him because he's savage, because of savagery, his lack of honor. So I actually liked that they didn't go straight to the Arrow formula they've kind of used the last several seasons.
Yes, and now the question becomes, what lesson does Oliver take out of this defeat? Does Oliver take out of it that he needs to become the same kind of savage that Diaz is in order to beat him? Or is it a wake-up call that he can't do it on his own? We'll have to see where that goes. But the big thing coming out of here is he's been arrested, and a certain teaser that aired after the episode I thought you might find interesting, Nick.
Yeah, decent.
Nevertheless, we'll have more on that next week. So, let's stack them up and rank them, Nick.
Well, it's hard to say because, you know, I guess what are we ranking exactly?
You can rank Supergirl, Arrow, and The Flash, and I'll rank Flash and Arrow.
Oh, Arrow, Flash, Supergirl.
Arrow, Flash for me. Both excellent.
Yes.
I think from what you're telling me, all three shows are really cooking right now. So
they are.
Good to hear. Now, finally, Nick, we can talk about the damn Walking Dead.
Yes. Yes, we can.
So Nick has finally caught up on all the episodes he missed of The Walking Dead. And I can elaborate a little more on some of my thoughts on the finale of The Walking Dead. And I think it's fresher in Nick's mind, so I really want to let him just go for a minute. But I'll preface this with saying I am going to agree with virtually everything that he's about to say. So take it away, Nick.
So I was at this point, you know, as people who have listened to the show probably know, I was about, I don't know, five episodes behind on Walking Dead. And so this week I had the opportunity to sit down and just watch them all back to back to back to back to back. And after having such a prolonged break from the show, I realized something very early on in this little mini marathon. And what I realized was I found myself coming to understand that I hadn't really missed the show during my time away from it. The pacing was bothering me more than I remembered it bothering me before I took my little break. The characters were bothering me more than I remembered them bothering me. Even characters that I usually liked just seemed to be grating on me for whatever reason. But I stuck with it. You know, I finished the episodes. I burned through them. As Greg has mentioned before, I got to, especially to that penultimate episode, the episode right before the season finale, and really enjoyed that episode. And so I was there, and I was ready for the season finale.
And, or so you thought.
And so I will say that for 40 minutes or so, it was fine. Nothing to like write home about, but okay, decent television. And then the last 20 minutes of this year's season finale of The Walking Dead have likely killed the show for me entirely. Greg and I have mentioned on these airwaves several times how we thought that any version of this ending that ended with Rick allowing Negan to live was going to be a bad ending to the story they were telling, simply because of the rules that the television version of The Walking Dead operates off of. The pre-established story, all the logic, it defies it. yes, I understand, well, that's what they did in the comics, but this is an example where just because Robert Kirkman wrote it doesn't mean it's good. In fact, I would argue that it's really fucking bad. So I had steeled myself somewhat for the possibility of that. So when it did, I predictably rolled my eyes and, like, was very down on the whole thing, but was not yet to the point of just outright, well, I'm quitting the show. Because I thought the episode was ending there. You know, Negan, Rick slashes Negan's throat. He then makes the stupid decision to save him. He gives his god-awful, you know, inspirational speech to all these people.
Preach.
Which by the way, let's point out the fact he just saved Negan of all people's fucking life. And then he threatens those people with, now you'll be expected to get in line, but if you don't get in line, there'll be consequences. What fucking consequences? You just let Negan walk, you dumbass. Anyway.
I also love how Rick sounds like Stone Cold Austin.
Hey, that's pretty
There's
good.
There's going to be consequences.
You know.
You're going to get your ass dropped with a stunner.
No, he wouldn't even drop him with a fucking stunner if he had, you know. Anyway. So, what I was not prepared for, however, was the 15 fucking endings that followed where we get updates on all these various characters. And so we see, for example, one of the best characters on the show, Morgan, go off into isolation. Which I know, is in service of him going over to Fear the Walking Dead. I get that. But I'm saying sheer Walking Dead perspective. It made no fucking sense. And let's be honest, the whole thing they had done with Morgan over most of the season made no sense. It was Morgan, as much as I love the character, was really representative of a larger issue that the Walking Dead writers and showrunners have had for quite some time. And that is, they don't seem to have the ability to tell different stories with these characters. And I don't mean different stories in terms of the larger group dynamic. I mean that each individual character seems stuck in a recursive loop over and over and over again. Carol, for example, she goes from, you know, vengeful woman who is on the verge of, you know, destroying everything, who is just the ultimate badass, to somebody who is swearing off people altogether, to somebody who wants no interaction with children, to somebody who loves children, and then we're just in this constant loop. And it's especially maddening because with so many of these characters, a lot of these evolutions take place off screen, where it's like you come back from mid-season breaks or season breaks, and they've moved to another spot on their predefined wheel.
Carol's a loner, then he's a team player. Then he's a loner, then he's a team player.
Morgan,
then he's a leader in the group, then he's a loner again.
Morgan values life and has his shit together. Then he's insane and murderous. Then he values life and has his shit together. Then he's insane and murderous. Rinse and repeat. Gabriel questions his faith. Gabriel is strong in his faith. Gabriel questions his faith. Gabriel is strong in his faith. Over and over a fucking yell. Whatever episode it was, Greg, that had another scene of Gabriel openly out loud questioning his gods, a la The Ultimate Warrior, I wanted so badly to just turn the television off. Because it, like,
I was hoping he was going to get killed in that episode. I really was.
And he fucking didn't.
He didn't get killed at all, in fact.
So you got this Morgan deal that makes no fucking sense. You've got the saviors being allowed to come into the hilltop, which makes no fucking sense. You've got them showing up at the damn sanctuary to repair everything for them using all their valuable food and resources. Again, no fucking sense. And I'm willing to go with you pretty far down that road. As much as I'm rolling my eyes at this point, I'm still not yet fully pissed off. And then they give me what I would argue from a character perspective, and I say this without exaggeration, it might be the worst written scene from a character perspective in the history of The Walking Dead.
Think of how much that covers.
Yes, but I say it like I mean it when I say it, because they give us the tease for what is to come, and their tease is essentially that there is going to be something of a civil war within the group, a split within the group. Because we see that after Rick's decision to spare Negan's life, he has greatly pissed off Maggie, primarily. Maggie, who over the course of the season, has been proven to be a far more effective leader than Rick arguably ever was, but certainly is at this point. She's rational. She is somewhat level-headed. She is making decisions that Rick is incapable of making due to his emotional state. And she is managing to do all this while simultaneously mourning the loss of her husband and also preparing to become a mother. So she is managing to put her own shit aside for the greater good of the group. She gets the bright idea here that because Rick spared Negan and because Michonne backed this play, that they both have to pay. And that they're going to bide their time, and eventually they're going to get their revenge. And who is they, you ask? They is Daryl. Which, hey, I can kind of go with that, with Daryl having a beef with Rick and him not killing Negan, except for the fact that one of your 15 fucking Return of the King style endings to this fucking episode, Daryl driving Dwight off into the woods and just letting him go. So you mean to tell me that Daryl is going to want to come after Rick in some sort of violent fashion for not letting him, for not killing Negan, but he himself just let Dwight, of all fucking people, walk? No sense. No sense whatsoever. So they have already pissed me off royally by this point, but then they put the shit cherry on top of the shit cupcake by having fucking Jesus, of all characters, in on this whole plot with Maggie. Jesus! Who they have had be nothing but a sanctimonious, judgmental ass over the course of this entire season, judging everyone, lecturing everyone about how, there's a better way. Do this without violence. We don't have to stoop to their level. Oh, shut the fuck up, Jesus. Nobody asked your dumb ass.
Right now.
And the problem with this whole thing is he has done nothing but push back on Maggie about using that means the entire time. And now she's going to pull him into this fucking subplot? And not only that, but like, he gives you the impression that he's going to be complicit with it? It makes no fucking sense for anybody in that room to be in that room. No one.
Right. He's the one that advocated for the survival of that long-haired douchebag in the Saviors group that was one of the worst of the entire group of Saviors. He's the one that allowed that guy to live. And he wouldn't let Morgan kill him, remember?
Yeah, it defies logic. This entire closing sequence of scenes defies logic for virtually every character on the show.
Horrible.
And then we also get a scene of Rick and Michonne showing up in Negan's hospital room or whatever, and then threatening physical torture. If I'm Negan, I'm calling their bluff. What are they going to do? They're not going to fucking kill him. They've made that blatantly apparent. So nothing that happens for the last 15 minutes of the show makes any sense. Nothing about it makes me want to continue watching the show. I don't even...
The character that looks the worst in all this is the main character of the show, Rick, who I've, as you know, Nick, have been controversially opposed to for several seasons, but who I was starting to come around in the last couple years. Well, they threw all that away in one episode, because keep in mind this about Rick. Promises at the beginning of the season, even at the beginning of last season, that he was going to be the one to kill Negan. Doesn't. Okay. Betrays Maggie by promising her he was going to finish it when it was done. Doesn't. Told Maggie at the beginning of this season, Nick, remember? He tells Maggie, you're the leader now. You're going to be a better leader than I ever was. When this is over, you're taking over and you're calling the shots. Lies to her because he's still calling the ultimate shots, right?
Right.
So, okay, let's go back a little bit further. Remember when Morgan came back and he was a pacifist and he was rational and he was normal and he didn't kill people and he let them live and it led to problems and Rick cussed his ass out every week and told him how stupid he was and how you have to kill in the world that they live in? Remember that?
Yes.
And remember how Morgan letting that guy live turned out to lead to bad things?
Yes.
Well, now Morgan has lost his mind again because he's a killer and is being extradited into his own world. And Rick, the motherfucker who started this whole thing and messed with Morgan's head in the first place, is suddenly Mr. Pacist again, saying we don't need to kill this guy who killed our friends in front of our very eyes.
Yeah, I mean, let's dial it back even to the finale, Greg. So the entire motivation for Rick sparing Negan's life is based upon Carl's death. And so it requires you as an audience member to, one, care about what the fuck Carl's dying wishes were, which I don't, and two, to buy into the idea that Carl's, one of Carl's dying wishes would have been for a, you know, a peaceful end to this conflict. That very notion ignores the entire fact for the vast majority of that character's past, especially from season 3 forward. Carl has been a bloodthirsty little douchebag. Like, the description they gave him was that he was overly influenced by Shane as a young child, and as a result, saw and thought about things differently than his father did. He was more aggressive. He was a shoot first and ask questions later kind of guy. And they never really showed you any believable motivation for him to change that. They just all of a sudden one day off screen decided Carl's a pacifist now and went with that. And now you were supposed to buy into him wanting the whole conflict to end peacefully and Negan not and not to die? No. Fuck that. Fuck virtually every character decision they make in this show in this episode because it makes no sense. For the versions of the characters they've written up to this point, fuck this show, I'm done.
And it's in certain situations, I say, don't overreact to one bad episode of a show. We've seen bad season finales before of shows. We've seen bad finales of several shows regularly. But on the other hand, very few episodes, individual episodes, are as important as this episode was. This was the payoff to not one season, but 2.5 seasons of storytelling. It culminates in this one episode, and they didn't drop the ball. They didn't fumble the ball. They fumbled the ball through the back of their own end zone, then did a safety punt and had it returned for a touchdown against them. The game's over, folks. I don't see how you recover from this as a show. Like, I just don't. I think that it was a slap in the face. It was idiotic. Way to try to placate the morons. And yes, I said the morons who are bitching and moaning if they do anything different from the comics. And I'll go one further. I haven't read that far into the comic, but it doesn't make sense for him to live in the comics either. But probably it makes a little more sense than it does in the show. I'm so done. Now, unlike Nick, I think Nick's really now. I'm going to try to give Fear the Walking Dead a chance with Morgan over there now and see if I like it any better than I did a few years ago. And then we'll probably try out the premiere for Walking Dead Month.
Oh yeah, I'll absolutely watch the premiere to maintain the running of Walking Dead Month. But unless, like, as I told people in the ultra exclusive Place to Be Nation Comics group chat, unless that premiere ends with Daryl and Eugene murdering everyone else in the group and then leaving together on a wacky cross country comedy trip, I'm probably not going to watch anything else after that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just hope they take Rosita with them on their trip.
Oh, she knows what she wants. That was blatantly apparent by the season finale. She knows exactly what she wants. She wants a little of the doctor.
You haven't had any love until you've had mullet love. I've heard that somewhere. I don't know where. But that brings an end to Redemption. And you know what that means, Nick? No, it doesn't, actually.
Yeah, it doesn't.
I take that back. It does not bring it into reading and watching, because we watched something else, didn't we?
We did. And my thoughts on it have been heavily documented at this point on Place to Be Nation. Greg, of course, is referring to Marvel's Avengers Infinity War, the culmination, or seeming culmination anyway, of 10 years of cinematic storytelling up to this point. I actually recorded a 3-hour plus podcast breakdown and review of the movie with the illustrious Tim Capel and the famous Jennifer Smith. That's up now on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. You can find it out there. So I guess really what people are trying to hear here is Greg's thoughts, which have not been captured in a public forum to this point.
That's right. Yes. You can find their thoughts on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. As for me, I have to say, I needed this movie. With the emotional state that I've been in lately and the kind of the way things have been going for me lately, I needed this movie to be good. And I got to say, it delivered on all counts for me. I haven't felt this way leaving a theater since 2012 and The Dark Knight Rises, which I don't know if we've gotten into on the show as much, but it is a very important movie to me and one that I'm higher on than virtually the rest of the free world. And so the whole time I was watching this movie, and I've had experiences since then. I love watching all these Marvel movies in the theater. They've all been great to watch in the theater. Ragnarok was amazing, and Guardians 2, and Guardians 1 for that matter. And all have been great to watch and fun to watch. The Avengers movies, of course. But the fact that at 7-year-old, I was reading The Infinity Gauntlet, and never thought in a million years that I would ever truly be able to see it on the big screen in live action and done in any kind of a compelling fashion. It was marvelous. Does it change a lot from that book that I read when I was a kid? Yeah, but so what? I don't care. It was entertaining to me. It made me feel emotionally in a way that whatever intellectual flaws I can find with the movie were washed out by the emotion that it made me feel. I can pick apart things here and there about the movie, but I don't want to. This is a movie that I really don't want to overanalyze. I just want to I was sucked into it so much, and they got so much right, and the characters were so great, and the acting was so great here, the performances. Finally seeing Thanos fleshed out and a version of Thanos that I thought was incredibly compelling and a great performance by Josh Brolin. Some of the best CGI I've ever seen in a movie in this thing. The performance of Zoe Saldana's Guardians career, making Gamora this incredibly relatable and sympathetic and just tortured character that we see on the big screen. Imagine the story of she's her whole planet, her parents and everyone else is wiped out, or half of it anyway, by Thanos, and he kidnaps her essentially. But for all intents and purposes, he's still her father, and she still has, whether she admits it or not, some level of him. And I thought it was just amazing. I thought it was a great movie, one of my favorite superhero movies that I've seen in the theater. And I know, I just on the show, I think, Nick, last week, that I was going to overrate this movie when I first saw it, regardless of what happened. Because I feel like I usually do with these when I first see them, especially if it's one that I have a strong attachment to. But I don't know, man. I hear people's complaints about things, and I understand them for sure. But like, I just can't make myself care. If that makes sense, Nick.
It does. It makes some level of sense. As I said, my thoughts have been well documented on the matter. But in brief, I really enjoyed the movie as well. I did think it had some issues with transitions, but I knew that was going to be the case coming in with that much to do and that many characters to juggle and that much going on. So ultimately, really, really enjoyed it. Had a great time with it. Don't know where it'll rank ultimately in the overall MCU pantheon. I struggle with this one more than any other because I don't feel there's an element of incompleteness to it. I feel like it more than any other installment to the MCU up to this point will rely so much on what they do to follow it. And it also relies so much on you having that knowledge of the 10 years that have come before. So I don't – I have concerns long term about how it's going to hold up as a standalone film. But for 1 2.5-hour chunk, a somewhat educated fan who's followed these things obsessively for 10 years now, hell of a good time at the movies. Can't wait to see where they go from here.
Yeah, and me as well. And the closing shot of the movie, which I'm not going to spoil for anyone that hasn't seen it, not the end credit scene, but the closing shot of the actual film, made me so happy and almost orgasmic. I can't even really express it in words. And I just want to throw a shout out to all of the actors in this movie. I thought all the performances were good. Most of them were great. I can't even single anyone out without taking up too much time from an already long podcast. But Pratt, Downey Jr., Saldana were some of the standouts. Brolin, of course, was a standout.
Holland
was very, very. There were just so many. I don't know who played him, but the Ebony Maw. Ebony Maw.
I think they ought to have Thanos' white order in the next film,
yes,
and have the Ivory Maw, and I think just the individual to voice him.
Now, coming your way is Thanos. Now, you got two choices here. Now you could keep the Soul Stone. I recommend it. Might not have an ask when he is done with you. Or you can just give it over to me right now, and I'll take it to him, and we'll all worship at the altar of Thanos like we should be. Now it's pretty simple. I mean, honestly, you've got Thanos, who's got the strength of Hodge, the toughness of Alden, and the diaper butt of Dr. Death, and then you got you. Now, what kind of a choice is that? Then again, maybe you don't want to give me the stone. Maybe you'd rather not give the stone away, and that is your right. I'm not here to have an argument with you. I am here to pave the way for the destruction of the universe as you know it. Quite frankly. I think that's the presses. One thing that is for sure about Infinity War is nothing's for sure. No. It's official that Infinity War has the highest grossing opening weekend ever domestically, with $257,698,183. Infinity War blew away Star Wars The Force Awakens by, it looks like, $10 million to get the new record. And I'm not sure what the global total is right now, but I'm sure it's up there too. Oh, I'm looking at it right now. Estimated global tally is $640.9 million, almost $100 million more than the previous record holder, The Fate of the Furious.
My lord. As of, not to rub salt in the wound, but as of this recording, Infinity War in 6 days has already surpassed Justice League's box office total for its entire theatrical run.
Incredible, and deserved, in my opinion. I love it. Yes. It may be my favorite MCU at this point, but that's what I'm not ready to commit to yet. But on first watch, it's my favorite MCU movie. I'm not sure if it's going to hold up as well as the Cat movies do, but we'll see. The second two Cat movies. Anyway, it set a new record, and that paves the way, by the way, for the rundown.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
Now let's see what... God. Dang it, Nick. Dang it. Folks, Nick Duke has sent me another picture of Rip Taylor. It is the best one yet. As if he is saying, oh, man. Oh, God. Well, let's stick with the MCU, because in our opening bit of the rundown, our weekly look at the news and notes of the comic book world, Walt Disney Company and co-president Louis D'Esposito indicates that Marvel Studios co-president indicates that Disney wants Marvel to bring back the Marvel one-shots short films that they put out on DVD and Blu-ray releases from 2014. Now, none have been created yet since the request came in, but apparently it's something Disney is pushing for, and I don't see any reason not to do it. Nick, what about you?
Yeah, and one thing that's interesting is the report notes that Disney has shorts attached a lot of the times to their Pixar and their Disney Animation Studios films. So I wonder if perhaps this couldn't be a possibility of these actually shorts that would be attached to the movie in theaters and not just on the DVD the way they used to be, which would mirror the Pixar and Disney Animation approach. Now, granted, animated movies are always going to run a lot shorter than live-action movies, especially live-action Marvel movies, so maybe that's not entirely realistic, but you know, I was always a big fan of these. I liked the concept of them. I liked the fact that they brought something new, and I liked the fact that they had a large hand in undoing certain events from Iron Man 3. So I'm all for the return of these.
Yeah, I don't see not to do them. I think they'd be a great little addition to the movie-going experience, although it would be hard to put one in front of an Avengers movie given the length. You know, whether it be Age of Ultron or especially this one, which is the long and view movie, and deservedly so. Or whatever we get in the future. But certainly for a movie like Ant-Man and the Wasp, why not have a have an attachment to it? Oh, Lord. Rip Taylor, ladies and gentlemen. Rip Taylor is your homework assignment.
Yes.
My homework assignment for everyone listening to this show right now, if you have any bit of red blood in your body, I want you to go to Google. I want you to type in Rip Taylor, and I want you to look through every single image that pops up on that Google search.
I agree.
And then I want you to report back to us through Twitter, email, or on Facebook through the Place to Be Nation Comics group. Rip Taylor, for God's sake, Nick.
He's a half-naked Indian, for God's sake.
Now, I can't take this anymore. Confetti everywhere.
We are popping ourselves tonight.
Well, what's probably going to be popping us here in a couple weeks is the release of Dead Peel 2.
Indeed.
And I'm expecting this one to be a success based on how good the first one was and the great trailers for this one.
Mm-hmm.
However, Ryan Reynolds had some interesting things to say about Deadpool 3. He doesn't think that there will be a Deadpool 3. He said on the press tour that he thinks going forward it'll be an X-Force movie that will have Deadpool in it. He also says, quote, beyond that, I know it's a pipe dream that would probably never come true, but I'd like to see a Deadpool Logan movie, a Wolvepool movie. But Hugh Jackman apparently retired, despite the fact I've been protesting almost hourly, end quote. So, no Deadpool 3 in all likelihood, or not in all likelihood, I shouldn't say that, but Reynolds says that he doesn't think there will be a Deadpool 3, although co-writer Rhett Reese has indicated there could be. But he says X-Force will be coming, and he's still hoping to get Hugh Jackman to come out of retirement for a team-up movie. What are your thoughts, Nick?
I would have to imagine that the seemingly impending Disney-Fox merger is going to have to play some sort of role in this, right? Like, we talked about how there have been X-Men projects, like the Kitty Pryde solo movie, or various other projects that Fox is allegedly putting into production that you and I don't necessarily believe will happen just because of the, you know, this acquisition that's probably going to go through. So I think my assumption that Reynolds is guessing the X-Force movie will probably get made before that acquisition closes, but that the thought of getting a Deadpool 3 into production before it closes is probably unlikely. That's not to say another Deadpool movie couldn't potentially exist in the future with Reynolds as Deadpool, but I think technically I would be surprised if Disney maintained any of the pre-existing Fox continuity. I think a Deadpool starring Ryan Reynolds would be made in the MCU at some point if the acquisition goes through, but I'm kind of with him. Deadpool 3 in this particular version, this particular lineage of the character, I don't think it happens either.
I hope it happens. I mean, it's got a very loose continuity anyway, I'm sure. But what about the Logan thing? Any chance?
I would say none. Although, the thing that gives me pause there is Hugh Jackman's been very vocal about his desire to one day be in an Avengers movie, and if that acquisition goes through sooner rather than later, I wonder if that might not sway him to come back. And then that would open the door to the possibility.
Would be interesting. Also interesting is DC Comics finally announcing the official name of the DC streaming app that will be coming our way soon, and it is titled simply DC Universe. We also got a logo for it. And we got the title cards for the first three offerings on the DC Universe app, and they are Titans, which has an awesome logo that makes me feel like it's going to be primarily a Dick Grayson, which is really exciting. We got a title card for Young Justice Outsiders, which is the third season of Young Justice, and a title sequence for the animated Harley Quinn series.
Mm-hmm.
And no release date.
An announcement for a fourth series as well.
Really?
Yeah, there's an announcement today that James Wan is going to oversee the production of a live-action Swamp Thing television show for the show as well. So extensive offerings in the works.
Yes, no release dates for the DC Universe app or individual series have been announced. But they had a mailing lot that you can sign up for. So that's pretty cool. Pretty cool. And what are your thoughts, Nick, on the DC Universe app? I think I'm pretty reasonably excited for these shows that they've announced. But I think both of us are hoping there is a comics element to this as well.
Yes. One of the taglines is actually used on DC's website for this, and it seems to be an official marketing campaign, is they refer to it as the ultimate DC membership. And for me anyway, anything that's going to tout itself as such, if it's going to be truly the ultimate DC membership, comic publishing backlogs has to be an element of this. That being said, I'd be highly surprised if it actually is.
Right.
If it is, if it's the dream DC service where it's their comics backlog, their television backlog, and their movie backlog, they can essentially set their price as far as I'm concerned. It's a service that I will absolutely be buying and will put a great value to me, honestly, as much of the backlogs of the comics as I'll probably utilize.
Yeah, I agree. Very interesting there. I don't expect them to come out and have a Marvel Unlimited level backlog. I mean, Marvel Unlimited has been kind of filling out its backlog.
Well, Marvel Unlimited, started from one place and has kind of slowly become
right.
I mean, it's still missing some stuff. Don't get me wrong,
but it's very
damn good where it is right now.
Absolutely.
But if they could at least get to a starting place comparable to where Marvel Unlimited was and build it from there and commit to building it from there,
even if they could find a way to maybe get around some of the because one of the issues, I think, is the issue of creator rights and how the payment structure works through one of these unlimited subscription services, which is something we've seen come up in wrestling and come up in UFC and various other entities out there. But it is a dicey situation, but just from a pure fan's perspective, I mean, Marvel's kind of, you can't really put the genie back in the bottle, right? I mean, it's the same thing with streaming versus pay-per-view.
Right.
I don't think any of us would be satisfied going back to a pay-per-view model at this point, now that we're all used to getting our big events for $9.99 a month.
Or Netflix even. I mean, you know, streaming and the internet has just changed the game so much that this idea that people are going to continue to spend $20 on graphic novels or, you know, $3 to $5 on single-issue comics, you're going to have to get at, you know, the curve at a certain point. So we'll see. We'll see if it happens. Again, I'm not expecting it to, but if it does, I know a couple of guys that will be very happy. I'll say that at least.
Absolutely. Well, one thing that I know some people are not going to be happy about is that DC Comics will no longer include complimentary access for digital versions of all of their $3.99 titles. These are the little digital codes that you would find inside your books that you could, you know, give to a friend who wanted to or sell to a friend. The complimentary digital program began April 2017, along with a price increase of several $2.99 Rebirth titles to $3.99. But as of May 2nd, those free digital codes are gone for most titles, even though the cover prices will remain the same. So, publisher states they will instead focus the digital code benefit on a smaller and more select group of books. Readers can anticipate the digital codes include on physical copies of number one issues of major titles, select event books, annuals, and other special books. Thoughts on this whole deal, Nick? It doesn't really affect me that much, but thoughts on it from your perspective? It
doesn't really affect me as much either. I mean, it affects me to a very minor extent, but it's a bad move. Again, this is an example of trying to put the genie back in the bottle. Marvel tried this last year, and it failed miserably, and people bitched about it. I would be highly surprised if DC didn't encounter a similar backlash here. People have now come to expect that if you're going to pay $4 for a comic book, you should be able to take that with you anywhere you go at any point in time, even if you don't have the print version. That's just – that is the modern age we live in. Mm-hmm. Either adapt to it or face obsolescence.
Even more so than comics already face.
Right.
So, yeah, I agree. It's really a brain-dead move and one that – is mistaking the forest for the trees because they're trying to avoid, presumably, what I just talked about, where someone buys a book and then gives it for free to their friend instead of their friend buying it. Well, here's the thing. At least you still get eyes on your product, and maybe someone decides they want to buy it. As it is, if I can't give a copy of this to my friend or keep it for myself to travel somewhere else, that do you think the person that is needing someone to give them a free copy of a $3.99 comic is going to suddenly decide to go buy a $3.99 comic? I don't think so. Not now. And like you said, it's also a matter of if you're paying for these already overpriced things, let's be honest, single-issue comics should not cost as much as they do. And you can't take it with on a mobile device or what have you? Ridiculous. I agree with you, Nick. It's a bad move. Hopefully they'll reverse it in the near future. But you know what's not going to be reversed? This podcast. Because we're at the end. We are at the finish line right now, Nick. We have finished the rundown. We have just gone through a litany of items. What are some of the things you've learned this week on the podcast, Nick?
Well, I've learned that the Lady Laura has certain feelings about Jonathan Kent and certain feelings about spitting versus swallowing. What else have I learned? I've learned that Rip Taylor is an American, a national treasure and a global icon. And I've learned that,
I've learned that you have agreed to one day gig me like the butcher.
That's a very good point. One day, sir, I will indeed gig you like the butcher.
Now, I can't help but looking up at our oversized grandfather clock that's here in the L-shaped studios. It's an L-shaped grandfather clock, oddly enough. Not really sure where we got it. But
that's almost as impressive as the hourglass we have in the other corner.
Right, which still works. You know, we don't behold the laws of physics in our own sanctum Sanctorum or whatever. What the hell is it?
The Sanctum Sanctorum.
Yeah, whatever. We don't We don't listen to your stupid laws of physics. But anyway, what I'm noticing on the grandfather clock over there is that there's a minute on the clock most, and that can only mean that it's time for the wrestling minute, and that minute begins right now. Lots of news and notes going on in the wrestling world right now, Nick. We've got not Kazuchika Okada, but Shinsuke Nakamura, and his heel turn has gone very swimmingly to this point.
Yeah, I'm loving everything about Shinsuke's presentation on SmackDown. I'm also loving the introduction of the new character, Mr. Bootyworth, for the New Day. SmackDown just right up my alley right now. And also, Greg, I think we should talk about the hot wrestling community right now. That, of course, being that Chris Jericho is set to return to New Japan Pro Wrestling very soon at Wrestling Dontaku in Fukuoka, Japan, billed to a match with Tetsuya Naito at Dominion in Osaka.
Whale, Fukuoka. That's tremendous. Excited about that. Your boy Naito against my boy Jericho. Going to be fun. And also, shout out to Seth Rollins on the roll of his career right now.
Naito's got to go over.
I agree. And that's the minute. We hit a minute, exactly. Tremendous. The wrestling minute's always a fun time. Now, here we say thank you for all of your time, ladies and gentlemen. Boys and girls, children of all ages, and even animals that may be listening right now. We appreciate your time and your investment. We hope that you spend that same time listening to some of our buddies across Place to Be Nation Pop, buddies such as Russell Sellers and the Sellers Podcast, Jenny and Miranda over at Geek and Sassy, David Sunday and the Sunday
Easy
Group.
Like David Sunday.
What else do we have? We just go home in the box, have their final episode. I recommend checking that out. What else do we have on the pop feed? A brand new podcast that you're ready to debut soon, Nick.
Yeah, it's very possible that you will be hearing the first episode of that before you hear the next episode of this. So, our show. Stay tuned. Stay tuned to the Place to Be Nation pop feed.
And talking conversation pop. Conversation comics.
Talking pop.
And, talking pop, of course.
And Greg?
Imaginary Street Podcast. we've got it all. We've got it all on Place of a Nation Pop. And we're much like the one Billy Gunn in that we're popular right now and we'll go away very quickly. But And also, Place to Be Nation Wrestling has a lot of great content up. JT and Chad are doing a great series now on the Monday Night Wars. Survey Says, of course, which is a big hit in my household. And just a lot of great content. So read some comics, watch some wrestling, enjoy Infinity.
Option. Speaking of the Place to Be wrestling feed,
but enjoy it.
You might want to keep your eyes out on that feed. There may be an appearance by a certain hard traveling fanboy in the coming week or so.
Oh, really?
That's what I've heard. I heard the political scuttlebutt in the back that I've been tabbed for an appearance on the mothership here pretty soon. So,
oh my,
yep.
Oh my, Nick Duke on the mothership ends the anchor. Tied to his ass.
Well, you know. There comes a time and place for everything, I suppose.
Yes, yes. Well, speaking of anchors tied to asses, we will no longer be dragging the rest of you down this week. We're going to be right back here next week to fill your lungs with more water. And by water, I mean useless bullcrap that we talk about each and every week. Only on the hard traveling fan.
Are you gonna give me fucking anything on this show, or why are we even here?
Listen up, slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question.
Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
I believe it was quite sudden and painful. Thank
you. Hard traveling fanboys. 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 Hard traveling fanboys.